You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 12. Every few years, universities get a report card on their research activities. It's a process known as REF, the Research Excellence Framework. REF divides the university into a set of subject areas, like physics, chemistry, history, law, and so on, and then it grades universities based on how active and how excellent their work is. One of the features of REF is a focus on impact. Simply put, impact is meant to measure how much influence our academic university work has had in non-academic places around the world. Because STS is such an interdisciplinary department, our work contributes to lots of REF categories for UCL. One area where STS contributes a big part to UCL's impact is in philosophy, and this year's REF results confirms that loud and clear. It's like getting top marks on your report card, and it's huge validation for the folks on the project teams. To give you a sense of what these projects involved, I put in a call to two of the project leads, Professor Sarah Edwards and Professor Phyllis Ilari. Sarah is Professor of Bioethics, Phyllis is Professor of Philosophy of Science. We talk about their research, and we talk about what makes it so impactful. As usual, I started our conversation by asking Sarah and Phyllis to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Ilari. I'm Professor of Philosophy of Science in the Science and Technology Studies Department at UCL.
Hi, and I'm Sarah Edwards. I'm Professor of Bioethics at UCL.
Fantastic. Well, welcome both of you. Sarah, let's get started with you. So we're talking about REF impact cases, and you were part of a REF impact case that was submitted through philosophy. Can you tell us what that impact case was?
Well, very topically, given the past few years, the impact case revolved around devising and developing ethical standards for clinical research during public health crises. The work, though, predated COVID. I mean, we've all been swept up by COVID, but this has a rather longer history. It was all inspired really by the rise of translational clinical science, and the work that I was undertaking initially looked at translational clinical science, and I was very surprised by the fact that it was all still very sort of sequential in terms of the methods, and it was taking sort of roughly 14 years or so before a new product would reach the marketplace.
Right. Let me just interrupt you quickly. So translational medicine is not changing something from English to Spanish. Translational medicine is moving something from research to the clinic. Is that right?
That's right. It could also be from moving from one clinic to another clinic, mm-hmm. but certainly translation is a very sort of loose term that was supposed to try and encourage more collaboration and connection between the laboratory and the bedside.
Right. So when we talk about translational medicine, we're talking about moving it from one kind of facility to another, and it's different rules of conduct, different procedures, different kind of training and background for staff. So lots of differences that need to be dealt with for the effectiveness to be there. That's about right, isn't it?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
And your research is on the ethics of that process, and so the impact case study is thinking about how do we make the transfer of, whilst we're transferring the medicines, what are the ethical issues? How does the ethical environment change, and how do we need to change our sort of rules or conclusions? Do I have that right?
Yes, yes, that's right. And crucially, how early can patients try out some of these new treatments, and what standards of science, what methods should be required before these new products can be made more widely available? The work, and this interleaves with some of Phyllis's interests, I know, over how we design clinical trials. And indeed, you know, what sort of distinction we make between real world practice or routine practice in medicine and the sort of the apparently rigid controlled environment of a clinical trial. And some of the thoughts that inspired this work related to the observation that there was just a false dichotomy between clinical research and routine practice. Most new products are heavily restricted to clinical trials, which need, you know, a lot of investment, a lot of time, energy, and sometimes patients who are in desperate need very often won't be provided with a chance of trying these treatments that are only available within a trial context.
Right.
It's looking at clinical research far more loosely and broadly, and trying to learn from routine practice, or at least early access, or what's often referred to as expanded access, in order to inform clinical trials and vice versa.
Brilliant. And the added twist in your impact case study and in your research more generally is your own interest is in new and emerging diseases, most of which don't have a known treatment. So I always think of Ebola as the classic case study for you, where it's an incredibly frightening disease. Things need to move very quickly. Decisions need to be made. And also on the other side, people are desperate because Ebola is terrible. And in a desperate situation, people can be willing to bend rules and to change their sort of understanding of what's allowable. And so your case study engages environments like that where people are genuinely desperate. That must be exciting, being right on the cutting edge of the research.
Absolutely. Exciting is one word for it. The feeling of responsibility, though, for trying to support research efforts in these environments is very daunting. And it encouraging to see that there's much more interest and willingness to look at the systems overall in order to try and facilitate and coordinate these efforts. I mean, the early work that we were doing predated even Ebola. So this is going back to a study that was published in 2013, which looked at how you might better design trials to advance what's often called the concept of equipoise, or it's thought that the classic tension between advancing the interests of patients generally and the interests of the individual patient could be best served by just being in a state of uncertainty. So if you don't know whether something's going to work or not, you can sort of randomly allocate patients to receive a new treatment, but they might not receive anything at all if they're in the placebo arm. Now, in the state of these sorts of challenging circumstances of a public health emergency, where the case fatality rate is very high. If you get assigned to the placebo arm, of course, that doesn't really bode very well. You might as well, you know, not be in the trial at all, except that you're contributing to science. So there's no sense of private interest or therapeutic relationship in the sense that we often regard it in routine practice. So a lot of the work was early on was over how we might better design trials in order to get that balance between advancing science quickly and providing a therapeutic relationship with individual patients in a way that would be considered more acceptable for them.
Phyllis, I want to bring you in. I want to talk about your impact case study, which is related but different. I think that's the way to say it. So, Phyllis, why don't you tell us first what the impact case study was, and then we'll talk about why you did it. So what was it?
Well, it was slightly complicated. I've been working for a long time on sort of data and evidence and information to do with lots of different things, and causality, very long-standing interest in causality. So the impact case study was a sort of combined thing. So one arm was really closely related to lots of Sarah's work, exactly what Sarah's talking about in terms of the complexity of how evidence works in medicine. We were working with sort of public bodies, thinking about how particularly evidence of mechanism might be more kind of more systematically used. It is used, but more systematically used alongside sort of clinical trial evidence and other kinds of evidence, because public health bodies, they publicize what they're how they assess evidence, how they make their decisions. And the idea was that the kind of use of things like clinical trials or even observational studies was much more systematically sort of organized than the kind of evidence of mechanism that might be used alongside, and actually might be especially useful in cases, the kind of cases that Sarah's talking about, when you just don't have 14 years to make a decision, right? So medical practices have loads of different purposes. Loads of different kinds of practitioners have slightly different kinds of priorities and key aims and timelines. And the thought was we need to be more pluralistic about evidence to give all those people what they need. And then the other arm was looking at, so the sort of data work and the evidence work and the causality work also fed into what's a massive issue now, which is data ethics. So we did some work for the UK government. I was involved in some work for the UK government with some looking at sort of data ethics framework for government data science.
So, folks, Phyllis is trying to sneak in a couple of big ideas here. Her impact case is really exciting because one is she emphasizes pluralism. So in a public policy environment, lots of different types of evidence is coming in, and policymakers need to weigh the different types of evidence coming in. There's also a lot of people wanting answers of really different kinds. So there's pluralism in those two ways. And the sneaky, brilliant thing that Phyllis has done is there's a big fight over that phrase randomized control trials and whether they're the gold standard of evidence. And Phyllis is sneaking in this idea that maybe it's not the case that randomized control trials should be the gold standard, that maybe giving a plausible mechanism could be really important when policymakers are making their decisions. So that's the thing. That's that brilliant academic insight that only comes from philosophers, and they sneak it in and maybe change policy. Phyllis, what do you think? Do I have that right, or is that just crazy?
Well, it doesn't just come from philosophers. There's lots of people working in this area. Randomized control trials are really, really important, but I think one of the thoughts is that they're a method. They're one of the methods and an important methodology, one of the methods Sarah was talking about. But they have their flaws, right? Not least exactly what Sarah was talking about, the conditions of randomized control trials tend to be fairly rigidly circumscribed, whereas real life isn't. And, you know, that's one of the challenges that you have in using the evidence you get from randomized control trials for lots of excellent reasons. For example, you don't really want elderly patients with who are highly vulnerable with lots of other diseases in randomized control trials, certainly not the first randomized control trials. On the other hand, obviously, you really need to treat those patients, right? They need those treatments. And mechanistic evidence also has its flaws, right? So sometimes what you know is very, very partial. Sometimes you have a really well-established mechanism for something, but you still find it quite mysterious what's going on, because actually the way mechanisms interact in the body is very, very complicated. But even so, if you have different kinds of evidence or evidence of different kinds of things and they've got different flaws, then when you put them together, you get a better picture, right, and a better understanding and a better chance of figuring out how to treat the particular individual patient that walks into your clinic with their very specific array of conditions and needs and preferences, right, for their life, their daily life.
That's what I really love about your particular impact case study, Phyllis, and that is about how to deal with the world as messy and very time demanding. So the idea that there's lots of fragments of material that can go into making decisions, and I think your impact case study is thinking about how to balance all those different pieces in a way that's actually going to work for policymakers. Sarah, when you hear Phyllis describe her work, she mentioned that your two projects are connected. What connections do you see?
Yes, this is a fabulous opportunity for us to, well, both compare notes, to fertilize across different sub-disciplines in philosophy. So while my main interest is in ethics, and Phyllis's is in philosophy of science, we come together over the limitations of the claim that the best way for social good is to conduct randomized control trials, and that for me, any early access or what's sometimes considered to be compassionate access for individual patients and new therapies is necessarily inimical to that social good. I think for me, I've been targeting this assumption that all new medicines, whatever the context, whatever the demands, whatever the social conditions, always must be channeled through these randomized control trials. And certainly conversations and joint work with Phyllis has provided more targets for us. But in the end, the idea is that we come out with both an efficient way of looking at clinical research in its broadest sense, which brings in these different methods rather than to impose a single method no matter what, and end up needing to do more studies afterwards in order to test how well those results from the randomized control trial work out in practice and in different contexts. Considering an example from our recent pandemic and the supposed definitive results from the UK recovery trial, dexamethasone, it has been enormously helpful knowing that steroids, as cheap and widely available as dexamethasone, really do work. And we've got a big randomized control trial that tells us that. We might have been able to conclude that earlier had we been more attuned to the mechanisms and the understanding of the disease as our understanding progressed. We also know that the implementation of those results in India might not be quite as good as we've seen them here in the UK. So we know that there have been outbreaks of black fungus, and we also know that steroids suppress the immune system. That's the very rationale for using the treatment in COVID, for severe COVID, where patients have got a very overactive immune system. But in the context of India, where sometimes there are other bugs lying in wait, it provides the opportunity for those bugs to get in and take over the patient. So we have to think overall what would be an efficient way of gathering scientific knowledge and being able to use these treatments in practice and in different settings.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Phyllis, you wanted to come in. Come on in.
I think Sarah's work just shows me. I mean, I never thought about research in an emergency before I first saw Sarah. I think it was talking about it, wasn't it? You gave a talk in our department a long, long time ago. And it just shows how many different places there are in medicine where thinking about this is, you know, evidence and ethics and how, you know, best to serve all the multiple plural needs there are important. But one thing, as someone interested in evidence of mechanism that people might be familiar with, of course, in the pandemic, is the way that evidence for the efficacy of mask wearing rolled out, because that was something that exactly didn't happen with randomized controlled trials. So that very much happened on rather messy kind of observational evidence, right? So people started to study the spread of the disease in populations that voluntarily kind of adopted mask wearing very early versus populations that didn't. And of course, lots of that evidence was mechanistic. And then advice was being sent out as to what kind of mask might be most effective, especially masks that could be made by yourself at home, because the immediate need, of course, was for medical people to have, you know, medical practitioners to have masks first. So there were lots of places where that debate was happened. And I'm sure everyone saw at some point during the pandemic the really useful visualizations that then went around on social media to explain to the public why wearing a mask might save their own and indeed their loved ones' lives.
Yeah, that's a really great example where lots of different types of data come together and policymakers have to make decisions. And you can see in the middle of the night, no doubt, they were thinking, if only we had a randomized controlled trial, but we don't have it. We have to make a decision tomorrow, you know, sort of thing. And that's a really nice example.
This is a perfect point in the conversation to pause and take a break.
like about SDS? I like the diversity in the curriculum here. I like that we get to read authors from all over the world that really strays away from a very homogeneous form of thinking and allows me to be exposed to a different perspective in the history and philosophy of science. And just the culture as well. I think the department has a great culture and everyone's very supportive.
Let's get back to my conversation with Phyllis and Sarah about their research and its impact. Remember, Sarah is professor of bioethics and Phyllis is professor of philosophy of science. We're talking about their contributions in philosophy to UCL's recent report card known as the REF.
Phyllis, I wanted to ask you something different, which is, you know, your natural working environment is of a philosopher. So it's seminars, conferences, papers, conversations, that sort of thing. And when you started to describe your own impact case, you used the phrase that we always hear in academic circles, which was, it's complicated. So you're in your impact case study, you're working with policymakers and policy planners. What's it like to work with them? I mean, how does your natural working environment change when you engage with them?
My experience was that it was really wonderful. So we were lucky enough in some of this medical evidence stuff. The medical evidence stuff has been a very long-standing interest of mine and also Brendan Clark's, right? So Brendan was very much part of this project at UCL. And a lot of this impact came out of a major project that was also done with the University of Kent, particularly John Williamson and Michael Wilde, who are still there. And there are many, many other people who were collaborators, too many I'm very aware to mention by name. But we were lucky enough to be able to work on that project with people from the National Institute for Care and Health Excellence in the UK and the International Agency for Research on Cancer. So people who've been engaged for, you know, long, long careers with medical evidence, right? With how to systematize medical evidence, how to think about the needs for different purposes. So particularly Mike Kelly, who was ex-director of public health at NICE, and Kurt Streif, who's head of the monographs at IARC. And while not strictly academics, the level of expertise that they had acquired was absolutely, I mean, awesome. It was really amazing. And the privilege of getting time to think about these things. And you really have to think about how the more abstract ideas that we have as academics, and particularly perhaps as philosophers, we really had to think about process. We really had to think about the particular role those public bodies had and how they organize their processes internally, particularly their evidence aggregation processes, who is allocated what task, what kind of expertise is expected of the people doing each kind of filtration, right? So literally staff sit down and read randomized controlled trials within, you know, NICE particularly, and present the results of those to expert panels. That was wonderful to really get that sense of those points of contact, the points of contact where the more abstract ideas could become more concrete in various ways. Just to give an example, was something like all randomized controlled trials have a sort of some kind of treatment, you know, some kind of intervention measure, and they have some kind of outcome measure. And those are obvious points of contact between the kind of processes that are done anyway and mechanistic evidence. Because one of the things that we talked about a lot was how you justify your, you know, your intervention measure and your outcome measure, right? Are those, you know, rather loosely defined variables that may or may not be connected to, you know, really solid mechanistic evidence. And there's lots of other things to say. I'm sure Sarah can say an awful lot from the ethical point of view on outcome measures and patient relevance of those outcome measures, which is another massive debate within evidence in medicine.
Sarah, is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, so to give perhaps what's become the classic example where the trialists just got it wrong. For arthritis, the most important outcome measure was assumed to be pain, whereas when talking with patients, it turned out that fatigue was the most important and problematic symptom. So, of course, the trials then were redesigned in order to take that into account.
That's a really great example where actually talking to the patients is really important. Turns out to be incredibly important in terms of deciding what you want to do. So, Sarah, let me ask you a different kind of question, and maybe this will be our last question. And that is, you mentioned 2013 as a date where some of the early papers in the project were were published. So Impact is meant to be not just a one-hit wonder. Impact is meant to be a long-term process where research is meant to slow cook and stew and then draw out policy value. Is that the case in your own research? And do you think this is the right way to see research in academia?
Oh, interesting. So yes, I think that that's been the case with my work. Whether it's the right way to look at impact broadly and whether it's now skewing what research is undertaken within the universities is an entirely separate question. I mean, I can talk to my own experience, having written a paper on how you might think about designing clinical trials during outbreaks of emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. Published then in 2013, we held a conference with WHO in the June of 2014, a mere 2 months before Ebola was declared an international emergency. And of course, things then really took off. There wasn't anything at all, really, in the literature, the published academic literature, addressing this question. So naturally, when faced with an emergency of these proportions, we were then in a position where discussions had to be undertaken at pace. There was then a lot of work with WHO to try and devise broader guidance for doing clinical research during emergencies of this sort. There was then investment in looking at how you do research and doing research on the ground. So I was then part of an international consortium, largely made up of clinicians, scientists, veterinary scientists as well. So this was supposed to be more of a One Health consortium where you're looking at diseases of zoonotic origin and looking at the health of the animals at the same time, but supporting the new institution of the African CDC that was created following the Ebola crisis. So we've never really had a break, as it were. not that I'm asking for one, although one might be nice. So I think things have grown steadily in terms of impact. But the research itself isn't standing still. And in fact, COVID has presented more challenges, different challenges in some respects. And the collaborations with practitioners, clinicians, policymakers have all really fed into that research by establishing what the issues are, how we might gather data to provide and inform these sorts of debates. I mean, what might be feasible? What sorts of infrastructure do we need to provide data sharing facilities? How might we detect outbreaks, index cases earliest? All of these are empirical questions, and I'm fascinated by those just as much as I am by the abstract thoughts and the research that feeds into the policy. I see it clearly as a two-way street.
And in fact, it sounds like, Sarah, you're saying to me that I've got it wrong. It's not ivory tower thinking and then later gets applied in the real world. It's more there's conversations in the ivory tower whilst things are happening, and then you quickly leave the ivory tower, to use the metaphor, and you're out in the real world. And in a way, the real challenge is whilst you're solving real world problems, the academic challenge is to find the time to reflect on it and theorize about it in a way that benefits the academic community. But it sounds like that model of the ivory tower it's so, dare I use the phrase 20th century, it's so old, that model. Do you think I have that right?
Yes, in many ways. I wouldn't like to see universities become so preoccupied with the REF impact agenda that what we often refer to as sort of basic science or indeed, you know, fundamental analytic philosophy becomes less important or indeed sidelined. Yes, there's now money that comes with impact cases, and the universities are understandably very keen, you know, to attract that kind of money. But the universities are intrinsically places where interdisciplinary and challenging conversations can be had. We don't engage in disruptive thinking, if I can steal UCL's sort of tagline, by being isolated academics or indeed practitioners without the really stimulating conversations that a place like a university can really encourage. I have just as many interesting and fruitful conversations with students as they come through the university system. Yes, they're maybe in degree context and they're maybe working very hard on their essays, but having the open discussions is critical, really. And We don't want to have impact becoming such a competitive and perverse incentive that it could undermine that sort of community.
We don't want it to skew the things that universities do. Phyllis, I think of you as a great example of a person who has built a whole career not solely in the ivory tower. All of your work has combined really hard academic philosophy and at the same time real world applications, whether it's your time working in data science and information sciences, whether it's the causality in medicine, whether it's the general work on mechanisms. I mean, how do you see this? When somebody says, oh, you're just an ivory tower academic, how do you respond to that?
There were these conceptual issues that they're really shared by lots of places, right? So lots of different kind of disciplines across the sciences are concerned with causality, strangely enough. And often when they're, you know, thinking methodologically, they really challenge their own thinking about causality. And the same is true of lots and lots of policy bodies, people making everyday decisions, actually. And that's really been what's interested me, rather than it being confined to any particular discipline or, you know, confined to academia. Although I do think that, you know, it's because of the academic context and because specifically disciplinarily, right, as a philosopher, I'm allowed to be interested in those conceptual questions and focus on those conceptual questions. That's allowed me to think about these things for a long time. And really echoing what Sarah has said, good impact takes a long time. And one of the things that I think Sarah didn't make explicit, but is definitely in her mind there, is that if somehow the impact agenda forces quick impact, it's not going to be good impact. And we also need to think about the role of early career researchers as well in that, because they need to have the time to develop these things. It's as a philosopher that I've been able to organise things like the Causality and the Science Conference series for a long time and constantly bringing together lots of different people from different disciplines who were always so pleased to get a space to think about these things, because the kinds of pressures in their own discipline didn't always allow for it. And it's exactly those kinds of ongoing conversations for many, many years that eventually led, for example, to the project proposal that then led to the work that led to the impact. Maybe they happen in other places than universities. I haven't looked at the whole world, but they certainly do happen in universities. They happen a lot in universities, and they're really vital.
What a great thing to say, Phyllis. I'm always reminded, I'm going to sneak Darwin in here. So 20 years of work to get The Origin of Species written and published. And then, of course, if we assessed The Origin of Species after a year after it was published, most people go, yeah, not very interesting, not really picked up. But then, of course, 10 years later, whoa, what a difference. So that short-term thinking, I think you're hitting on a really important thing. Sometimes it really is. The research hits and bang, a really fantastic thing. But quite often it's not the case, and just giving people time, particularly early career researchers who have brilliant ideas, who are well on their way, just give it a bit of time. It's more like landscape gardening, isn't it, than picking up a fully grown tree at the garden center. It's landscape gardening is what we do. Anyway, right, so thanks very much, both of you. But before we end, is there anything that either of you wants to add that you think you want to say here?
Well, only to, well, congratulate Phyllis and to recognise what a fabulous environment UCL offers for such thinking. Yes, it sometimes seems a little fragmented as an institution, but we're very, very proud indeed. And I have to say, fond of it as an institution. It provides all sorts of freedoms and often support that I haven't necessarily seen elsewhere. So thank you, UCL.
Great. Thanks very much, Sarah. Phyllis, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely agree with Sarah that the kinds of conversations you can have over the length of time you can have them, really wonderful at UCL. And just to shout out to collaborators, I think. So my collaborators at Kent, collaborators internationally, the collaborators in the various public health agencies. And I haven't said much about the data ethics, but there were lots of just those conversations, the random conversations that happen that really continuously affect your thinking. So thank you to the data ethics group. And those others who were on the Cabinet Office Committee as well.
Brilliant. Well, that's fantastic. I think that's a wrap for today. And I'd like to thank both of you for taking the time to have a conversation with me today. So thanks very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to Sarah and Phyllis for taking the time to talk about their work. I've added links in the show notes to their research and their impact in case you want to find out more. When the report card comes out, every university promotes, and there's a lot of hype thrown into the media. The main point for me, I think, is that there's an enormous amount of great work underway in UK universities. It's relevant, it's powerful, and we contribute across a huge range of the British economy. The idea of an isolated ivory tower simply is a myth. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're wondering about our degrees in teaching, just get in touch. We're always happy to talk. That includes asking us about our brand new master's degree in science communication or our long-standing undergraduate degree in history and philosophy of science, now with study abroad options too. Music today included two pieces, Rolling at Five by Kevin MacLeod and Silly Intro by Alexander Nakarada. Both pieces are available on the website filmmusic.io. And in the break, you heard one of our master's students, Roha Ali Khan. Remember, you can find out more about the show and tell us what you think just by visiting our website. Here's the address, so write it down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks for coming along. Till next time, everybody, I'm Professor Joe Kane. And remember that together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.